Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Every consumer has a small box in his head. Everyone has a soap box, a bread box, a cereal box, a shampoo box. This box is the target of $46 billion a year in advertising. If we use creative foreplay before we penetrate, we'll...
Benefits. How many syllables, Mario?
We'll never know. The corporate bylaws make it very clear that the only way we can determine a new chairman is by democratic process. Paragraph 68 specifically states that nobody can vote for himself.
Enough, Carcass. Let's get the votes in.
How can we talk about who's going to be chairman of the board when my father's laying dead on the table?
One vote for Elias, one vote for Bissinger, 9 votes for Swope.
Swope! You don't have to accept. It's a terrible job. Don't take it, Swope!
The man's been elected and you voted for him.
We all voted for him. Because we thought no one else would vote for him. Putney Swope is the new chairman of this board. And I will defend that mistake with my life.
The changes I'm going to make will be minimal. I'm not going to rock the boat. Rocking the boat's a drag. What you do is sink the boat. And there's no sense sinking nothing unless you can salvage with productive alternatives. Brothers, you can't change nothing with rhetoric and slogans. Because if a man's really got the truth in his pocket, he doesn't talk about it. He hangs it out on a shingle where people can see it. So from now on, the name of this agency is Truth and Soul.
TS, baby.
That's right. No smoking.
Welcome to another episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Rob St. Mary.
And I'm Mike White.
And on this episode, we're talking about Robert Downey Sr.'s 1969 independent underground classic, Putney Swope. The film tells the tale of a token black man on the board of a Madison Avenue ad agency who gets elected to take over when the chairman of the board keels over on the boardroom table. Swope, played by Arnold Johnson, changes the style of the agency, fires pretty much all the pale faces who used to run the place, and then rechristens the agency Truth and Soul. During his time running the agency, Swope steals his employees' ideas, creates outrageous ads that actually catch on, so much so that the President of the United States calls him and pushes Swope to do an ad for a car company he's not hip to or really likes, and upsets all the revolutionaries who came to him in order to shake up Madison Avenue and America to begin with. But of course, there's much more than that. But that's just a good place to start. So, Mike, do you remember when you first saw Putney Swope and what you thought?
I didn't see it until maybe 5-6 years ago. Rented it on DVD, and the first time through, I didn't know what the heck was going on because it just has such a unusual tone to it. Having seen more of Robert Downey Sr.'s work, now when I watch it again, I can really appreciate it much more because his tone kind of turns on a dime and there's just a lot of kind of corny humor here and there and some just absolute bizarre stuff going on. And when you realize, oh, well, this is kind of much more of an experimental film, feature length, than, you know, a typical narrative, then it kind of becomes much more appealing.
Definitely. I mean, there's a lot of strange lines and like throwaway jokes and weirdness that just all seems to blend together in some way that to me kind of works really well. I mean, I saw this film, I think I saw it after I had read some interviews with Paul Thomas Anderson about Boogie Nights. And he was talking about how Robert Downey Sr. was this big influence on him and things like that. So this was late 90s. And it's something that I go back to from time to time. I've probably seen it 20 odd times. And I really enjoy it.
I'm a big fan of advertising movies. I know that's such a limited subgenre, but I really enjoy things like, you know, How to Get Ahead in Advertising or Crazy People or the old Max Headroom, you know, the original TV series. Coming to this, I was very excited to see more of a, you know, an ad agency kind of thing. And I really appreciated the commercials that were thrown in and just the politics behind the scenes. And I really enjoyed, it reminds me kind of a blaxploitation feature, but rather than making the black people the heroes, you know, Putney comes in, he is kind of heroic at the beginning, but then he kind of becomes as bad as the white guys that he replaced as we go along.
Consider the time that it came out. It was made in like 68, came out in 69, and it deals with race and all that late 60s revolutionary politics. And the fact that it's done by a white director with a mostly black cast is kind of interesting. You know, this film, when it came out, all of this stuff was in the zeitgeist. Things like the Black Panthers. I mean, this was around the time, like literally less than a year or so after Martin Luther King was assassinated. You had already had the assassination of Malcolm X, the rise of what we would call the Black Power movement and things like that. So to have a white guy do a film that not only makes fun of, in a way, satirizes revolution or satirizes that movement at times, or maybe just certain leaders or the idea of, you know, that basically any system becomes corrupt no matter who's in charge. I think it's really bold statement for that time when everything it seemed like in the popular culture, in the zeitgeist at the time was all about, you know, power to the people, stick it to the man, we're going to take over, we're going to have a revolution. And I think that really this film seems to me like it would have come later. Like people would say, like, maybe this is like Nixon era post Watergate attitude, like looking back, if you know what I mean, on all of that revolutionary politics of the late 60s and going, you know what, it really didn't work.
Yeah, very same as the old boss kind of thing. And it's funny, yeah, that he's doing this while this stuff is happening. And there really is no real calm voice in this whole storm that's going on. I mean, the movie just moves forward relentlessly. There's no kind of time for reflection as we're going through. I think the only times where we kind of get a break from the actual Putney narrative is when we go to the Arab character. I love that he's called the Arab, and it's Antonio Fargas is kind of, I think Downey points this out in his commentary on one of the DVDs, is that he's kind of Putney's conscience, you know, just kind of saying all the things that somebody else should be saying to Putney and just kind of, you know, really calling him out on the carpet and taking him to task for all of the awful things that he's doing. And those are the only times where we really kind of stop and reflect a little bit. But there's no, like, you know, main hero in this film that you're really pulling for, you know, one of these kind of like, you know, even in like Superfly or something where you're pulling for Priest and everything. But in this film, it's just like, you know, you're watching Putney and yeah, he's great to watch and everything, but he's not like very heroic whatsoever.
No, not at all. I mean, Antonio Fargas, this I think probably is his first film. I don't know. I have to do a little more research, but he's just incredible. Like you were saying, I mean, he would to me represent sort of, you know, and with the name the Arab, I guess, represents like the black Muslims or something. Because you can see like kind of archetypes throughout the film. There's like the obvious Black Panthers, you know, there's guys with berets. At one point, Putney even wears like a Castro hat and a cigar, you know. There's like all of these little nuances and pokes at all of these various revolutionary ideas. And to me, Antonio Fargas is just, when he's on screen, it's amazing. You just got to just with your jaw open.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Good stuff. I mean, yeah, he is amazing. And yeah, he is kind of outside of the narrative because Putney has no problem firing anyone and everyone that kind of, you know, crosses his path, no matter what, you know, just the guy that comes to him and says, you know, I'll do anything and I've got all these great ideas. And he's just like, you know, why should I pay you if I can get those same ideas for free kind of thing? It's just like, you know, he's just completely ruthless, but the Arab is there just telling it like it is the entire time, every time he's on screen.
I'm not gonna take all this crap. Everybody knows you a jive nigger. You done pulled all this jive shit. Your mother had a creative idea when she born you, and you had to go and blow that. And you're gonna come and try to show us all this crap. A nigger sitting up there eating cornflakes, man, you ain't had nothing original since you got here. You stole the idea about bombing sick. You got it from your wife. Are you gonna tell me that's a lie when she told me herself? And that little nephew who gave you that idea for that other thing, and you got rid of him. Ain't nobody around who helped you in anything. Everybody either been shut up, cut up, or been put out.
We're talking about a film that it came out, from what I understand, like around the same time as Easy Rider. And people cite Easy Rider, obviously, and all of that is a huge influence on the things that came after. And what's interesting about this film specifically out of Robert Downey's movies is that you can see direct pull with other filmmakers who have been influenced by this film. One that I think is interesting is the Coen brothers in Hudsucker Proxy. But instead of the chairman of the board falling over dead on the table, he jumps out the window, and then they put this shill in to run the place, which in a way is kind of like Putney Swope, at least in terms of its overall kind of idea of someone coming in who's not necessarily the chosen people that usually run the place. But the bigger one really is Paul Thomas Anderson. And if you look at Boogie Nights, there's three different references to this film in that film. There's the Don Cheadle character, whose last name is Swope. You have the scene, the Alfred Molina scene, which is just manic and insane, with the guy in the background lighting firecrackers the whole time.
Oh, yeah, that is one of my favorite scenes. That scene is what I remember the most from Boogie Nights.
Come on in, great to see you. Take a seat. You want something to drink? A pill, a little coke, a little dope, I got everything.
No.
You sure? You want something?
No, thank you.
Huh? Okay. So, got something? Huh? We got something here?
There it is. That's all right. A fat half key right there.
All right.
And that is some quality shit. If you want anything,
don't worry about it.
That out. I mean, go ahead. You know, if you want.
No, wait. Except build up.
And there's a scene in Putney Swope that the character who comes, Wing Sony, comes to talk to Putney Swope about his mousetrap, and he's just lighting off firecrackers during the whole scene.
Hey, man, what's this thing? Do-it-yourself Pearl Harbor?
He's Chinese, Swope.
I don't care what he is. We're going to get that account.
Let's go.
And then the third kind of, paying tribute to this person that's given Paul Thomas Anderson some influence is he actually puts Robert Downey Sr. into Boogie Nights, and he's got a scene with John C. Reilly and Mark Wahlberg that's pretty funny.
All we need is tapes for it.
No, you don't get them until you pay.
In our situation, that doesn't make any fucking sense.
Wait, we can't pay the price of the demo tapes unless we take the demo tapes to the record company and get paid.
Hello, exactly.
That's not an MP, that's a YP. Your problem. Come up with the money and I'll give you the tapes. That's it.
Okay. All right, now you're talking above my head, all right? I don't know this industry jargon, YP, MP, whatever, okay?
I think if it wasn't for this movie, because I can't think of anyone really before it that was satirizing advertising, I don't think that you would have had what came down the road with things like Saturday Night Live or, Kentucky Fried Movie or Groove Tube or something like that.
The only advertising movie I can really think of before that is kind of more that whitewashed advertising agency thing. There was a Doris Day, Rock Hudson film where they were selling this imaginary product called VIP. But that was very white bread kind of thing. So Putney definitely kind of turned that thing on its ear. Yeah, I totally agree with you about the Hudsucker Proxy, because there are those just absolutely bizarre other chairmen of the board, sitting around the table. That one guy who continuously corrects everything, as far as with the mezzanine, that like little line that he puts in with how many floors are in the building and everything reminds me a lot of the just absolutely kooky characters that that Downey has sitting around the table. I mean, I love the old guy that he has, the whole how many syllables, Mario? I mean, that guy is great. And it's nice to see how many of these actors would then later on, continue to work with Downey in his films.
That's the thing that's interesting about that boardroom scene is when you watch it, it's so disjointed in terms of what everyone's saying to one another. It's almost like they're talking in like code or something. It's really weird. Like, but there's a humor to it. Each of them are saying different things, and it's kind of like almost you're picking up on like half a conversation here and a half a conversation there. And it's just, it's connected to the overall idea, but it's just really kind of bizarre that people, you know, it's obviously stylized. It's like, this is not real. This is not like how real people sit around a boardroom and talk. And then you don't hold the vote to figure out who's going to fill in after the guy's dead and literally still laying on the table. And then while you're at it, just feel free to help yourself to the contents of their wallet.
That whole boardroom thing kind of, you know, predates a lot of what Altman was going to be doing pretty soon, too, with like the overlapping conversations and all this kind of stuff. Really, you know, very revolutionary for MASH, but this one comes right before MASH. So it's like, you know, you could look at Downey as kind of, you know, a good predecessor of that as well.
Definitely. Well, you know, about 2 weeks ago, we were lucky enough to get a chance to talk to Mr. Downey just as a major announcement was happening. And no, I'm not talking about that iPad 3 thing or whatever the hell they want to call it. We actually talked to him the same day they announced that. What is it? The new iPad? The iPad 3? I don't know. Apple, tell us what you want to call it. But yeah, this was a big announcement that came that day. Matter of fact, for us and fans of Robert Downey, probably even more important than that announcement of the iPad.
Right. The day we called Mr. Downey, Criterion announced that it was releasing a box of five of his early films, including Putney Swope. Okay, we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back with an interview with Robert Downey Sr.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at adamandeve.com.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to Forgotten Flicks. I'm Joel, and I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Jason.
The whole point of the Forgotten Flicks podcast, the idea behind it, was that we wanted to create something, a mouthpiece for fans of movies from the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, the movies that we all grew up with.
This was one of the worst movies I've seen in a long time.
You are full of crap. Are you being serious?
I will never, ever see him as anything else but Edgar. The cockroach guy from Men in Black,
Full Metal Jacket.
I loved it. His playing that Edgar role in Men in Black was hilarious.
Who do you think you are all of a sudden? I can't believe you hate this movie.
Everything is so contrived, painfully so. I'm just going to read through my notes. And whether you remember the movies or you forgot about them, or maybe you never even heard of the movies we're talking about, the point is that we're all keeping the memories of the movies we love alive.
Find us on iTunes or ForgottenFlicks.com.
Thank you.
can't believe the good timing we have today, just hearing that Criterion is releasing a whole bunch of your stuff on DVD finally.
Yeah, isn't that nice?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's great. Five early films, all black and white.
Yeah, but it kind of kills a lot of my questions, because I was going to ask about what those films were like, why they're not on DVD, you know? Come on.
They were saved by Mr. Scorsese.
I thought that he had a hand in that. That's terrific.
Yeah, he preserved four of them, and, there were no negatives. One of them was found in somebody's closet somewhere, a print, and then the anthology put it together a couple of years ago. So it's been great.
A few of them I've managed to see, but...
I don't know how, because whatever was on the internet was like shot off a wall somewhere or something.
Yeah, that was about the quality of like Chafed Elbows. I can't wait a good copy of that.
But now it's all fine, so, you know, within reason, you know.
Wonderful.
Excellent. Sounds good.
Yeah, Criterion's a great place, too.
Yeah, we saw that video online of you going through the closet and telling some stories of the various films.
Everybody gets in the closet if you're a filmmaker over there, and you can leave with whatever you want. It's great.
For those who aren't familiar, I mean, how did you get the opportunity to start doing your own stuff?
I was writing off Broadway plays that were being put on at midnight at a place called the Charles Theater, which was on Avenue B. Then I went to work at the Village Gate as a waiter. And one of the guys who worked down there said, are you writing stuff that could be filmed? And I said, I don't know anything about film. And he said, well, neither do I, but I have a camera. And so I had written something. In fact, it's one of the five that will be on the pack. And we went out shooting and grabbed a couple of actors and made this film. Actually only one critic really responded to the film at all, and he loved it. That was the New Yorker magazine, and then it really had a little audience down in the Village, and that's how it started.
When was it, like 61, 62, 63, something like that?
62 or 63. That was called Babbo 73.
And that was a really interesting time in New York. I mean, there was a lot of folks doing all kinds of underground stuff, so you sort of became part of that scene, per se?
I think that's true. I think that's what was going on. But it wasn't very competitive. It was more, how can I say it? It was more, let's have some fun. Since we don't know what we're doing, let's have fun.
Can you do us a little, like, name-dropping some of the folks that you're hanging out with, like who? Jonas Mekas and Jack Smith?
Well, actually, he took Babbo 73 into the Village Voice column he was writing and really did a great little piece on it. And really, when it was in a theater downtown, people were showing up mainly because of Jonas. And he's done that with a couple of my films. He's been great. He was the only voice at The Voice that really cared about trying stuff, new stuff. And he's still here. He's 90 years old.
Just a great resource, that guy. I mean, just so much stuff in terms of his own stuff and how much he's championed so many great filmmakers throughout the years.
Yeah, do you know him?
I don't know him personally, but I know him, you know, by his writing and by his work and reputation.
Have you ever seen him on film or anything?
I think I've seen a few interviews with him.
Yeah, you can't understand much of what he's saying, but you understand exactly what he's saying, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, there's definitely a passion that comes through with him. A few years later, I understand you worked at like an ad agency or a film company in some way.
No, it was a place that made, actually a film of mine, Chafed Elbows, got me a legitimate job making experimental commercials at this production house. And something happened that provoked in me a way to write something about, I guess, advertising and the racial thing that was going on and with the, you know, radical this and black power that and white people and blah, blah, blah. All because some guy was doing what I was doing, said, you know, hey, you do the same job I do and you get more money. And so I took him in to see the boss and I mentioned that. And the boss said, Bob, if I give him a raise, I got to give you a raise and we'll be right back where we started. And that provoked Putney Swope.
Mr. Swope, I do exactly the same job as the other executives. But I don't make as much money as they do. I don't think that's right.
If I give you a raise, everybody's gonna want a raise. And if I give them a raise, they'll still be making more money than you. And we'll be right back where we started.
never thought of it that way.
And that's why you get less money, because you don't think.
Which is the great line that I always use from time to time in my meetings at work.
About that, you mean what I just said?
Yes, I've said to several people as a joke.
Yeah, right. It really happened.
Yeah,
and he was a good guy, that boss, but that was his logic.
It's just such great logic.
Yeah, exactly.
But the, you know, the thing that's interesting about Putney Swope is that, you know, obviously you're a white director and you have pretty much an all black cast, and there's a lot of politics and various things and race that's going on. And how was it trying to do a film like that at the time when there's so much stuff going on within the African-American community?
Well, when I would show up at certain towns on the East Coast to open that film, with the distributor would send me around. There were some people who were shocked that I wasn't black with a name like Downey. It was kind of strange. But generally, making the film was interesting because I was able to ask certain guys who were on the film, you know, what I've written, it doesn't ring true to me. How would you say it? Or how would you do it? And at least five or six times I can remember the stuff that, when I saw the film recently, stands up, came to me that way.
It's a film that obviously I'm sure people weren't rushing to your door to hand you fistful of money to make. So how were you able to get like the locations and the funding to do it?
We shot in different places at night and pretended it was all the same place, if you know what I mean. Like we would be go in at say 10 at night, we'd have to be out at 6 in the morning. The boardroom scene in the beginning, we were not allowed out of the boardroom, so we had to put all the black guys underneath the boardroom table while we were shooting the white guys. And then when the black guys took over, put them at the table and put all the white guys underneath the table. You should have seen what was going on there. You know, it was funny.
The cast is great. You have some amazing actors in there.
The lady who was helping me cast the thing would just find interesting faces and bring them in. I just basically cast the first 40 people in because they were all interesting, and then went from there. And the leading guys or whatever. Actually, I lost a guy who was going to play Putney because he was afraid of getting thrown out of the union, his union, if he did this non-union film. And so he bowed out. And then I cast this guy who's in the film, who you see, because he looked great, but he couldn't remember any lines. So my cameraman said, don't worry about it. Look, that beard he has. You can put anything in there, even what you wrote, if you want. And that's what we did. That's my voice in there.
Hey, Swope, what do you think of the Panthers?
They look good against the Bulldogs, but they need more depth at quarterback.
It seems like pretty much everything that Antonio Fargas is saying seems to be coming right out of his head. Is that true? Or
I think that's, let me see if I can get Putney back. It's been too long. Yeah. That's half right. Half of it was him. He was in a play on Broadway called The Great White Hope with James Earl Jones. He was a kid, and he used to join us at night after the play, and I'd just turn him loose and give him a couple of key things, and that's it.
Get on out! Yeah, no more taking pictures of those jive cans and jive bottles and skinny leg bras with stockings on them. Get on out of here! We could have some greasy fingers and some chicken and all the beautiful things that people have who have it, and you ain't got it. So get on out, you understand? We're not gonna take any more of your jive. Where's where truth and soul, you understand? Truth and soul. Because we got it, and we got a brother that's going to make it right. We got Brother Putney.
He's a great guy, Tony. He was in other films of mine, too. And in fact, I just spoke to him recently. You've seen him before, I'm sure, other than Putney Swope.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm a big fan of I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker, and he was awesome.
There you go.
That. Yeah.
Car Wash.
Oh, yeah. Car Wash. He was perfect. And Starsky and Hutch. Jones. Rob said Starsky and Hutch, and I said Cleopatra Jones.
That's right. You got them both.
On the audio commentary, you had said that you thought Alan Arbus was a black guy. Was that before you met him, or is that after you met him?
All the way, until finally we were well into the film, and then I realized that he was just a Jewish guy with an Israel rather than an Afro, you know.
Sonny Williams, our copywriter, just got busted at Radio City. He was sitting in the first row, and when the Rockettes came on, he opened and closed his raincoat and exposed himself.
Bad PR. Tell Sonny next time he shows it, I'll make him a creative director.
Sonny, if you don't straighten up, we're going to send you to Hollywood as a choreographer.
And then I used him in Greaser's Palace as the leading guy in Greaser's Palace. A lovely guy. He's still around. I don't think he acts much anymore, but he's a lovely guy, and working with him was a pleasure.
What about Stan Gottlieb, the guy that played Nathan?
Well, I met him in a phone booth. It's true.
Nathan, you a good businessman, and you're not a cop-out, so I'm going to let you stay.
I want a contract that guarantees me an expense account. Stock options, 22 weeks vacation, a company car, a box at Jay Stadium, a percentage of the gross, total creative freedom, transplant insurance, and a no-cut clause.
Nathan, you're corrupt.
Thank you.
He was on the phone, and I was waiting to use the phone, and he came out, and we kind of looked at each other, and I said, would you be in a film? And he said, well, I actually work right here. It was the Bleecker Street Cinema, and we were right outside. And he said, I handle distribution there. And I said, I haven't noticed you before. And he said, well, yeah. He gave me his number, and I went, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4 films I did with him. He was great. He actually was shocking in a way. He was, though being Jewish, he was a conscientious objector in the Second World War. Figure that out.
He became sort of part of your stock company. Another guy I want to ask you about that was part of sort of the stock company in the early shorts, too, is Larry Wolfe.
Oh, yeah. Well, I just saw him for the first time in 35 years, about a month ago. He came to New York from California. I hadn't seen him. And I'm working on something new, just finishing up the writing of it. And I said, you got to come back. He said, oh, I'd love to. So it's fun to see these things continue.
How did you meet him and then sort of what happened to him?
In a bar.
He's in your stuff. And then I don't really know kind of what happened to him after.
He didn't do much with anybody else. He's also written stuff. And he actually was the roommate of the actor Peter Boyle. And they used to do comedy together and stuff like that. But I met him over near the Charles Theater, which I mentioned earlier, in a bar. I just had never seen anybody like him. And he's funny, you know, he's great.
Keep some money, Swope, but don't put it on the air or I'll be out of business.
What's wrong with it?
Too much tailpipe.
Did he talk like that or was that a put-on?
No, he's different every time. In Greasers, he plays a monk. And then a later film, he played a couple of just strange kind of characters. He'll always try something if you give him a challenge. He did all the voices in Chafed Elbows, practically. He's in Babbo 73. And we just had, it's funny you bring him up. We just got together. It was great seeing him again.
Did you originally plan to have a midget couple as the president and the first wife? Or did that just kind of
happen? Yeah. And the manager of the little people brought in 5 of them, and I had to pick 2 of them. And it turns out that though they played husband and wife in the film, they were brother and sister, which was funny. They were just lovely people, and they enjoyed having fun.
Is Mr. Swope in?
Huh?
This is President Mimeo.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
Yeah.
Guess who?
Marcus Garvey.
Nope. Try again.
President Mimeo.
How did you guess?
I used to be an exterminator.
You might be saying I used to have an agency if you don't get moving on the Borman 6.
I love her reactions when that scene of the guy telling jokes is just amazing.
Oh, yeah, that guy. That was just a bum on the street we found.
Oh, he was great.
Wasn't he great? Mr. Oh, yeah. President.
Yeah.
That guy.
Mr. President, did you hear about the woman who asked her husband to walk out to the garbage can with her? Are you out of your mind, replied her husband. Not at all, replied the wife. I'd like the neighbors to know we go out together once in a while.
Actually, I saw the film recently up in SUNY Purchase. They showed it. This filmmaker I know is a teacher there now, Chuck Workman. He's great. And I went up there and I expected, oh, God, this again and the Q&A and blah, blah, blah. And it turned into a great night. There were like 300 kids there and they all got it. You know, it wasn't to them. It wasn't an old film.
Well, yeah, it's still very fresh even today.
That was nice to know, to see that.
When it first came out, what was the audience reaction like?
Mixed. A lot of people. Actually, it couldn't even be distributed for a while. Nobody wanted it. You know, the screenings were kind of frightening because I had other stuff that was down the village. That was easy. And now I brought this out. It looked like it was going to be on the shelf. And finally, one, the guy who backed the thing sent one other distributor over, and he was late, and I wouldn't let him in the screening room. And he finally pushed his way in and said who he was. And as he was leaving, he said, "I don't get it, but I like it. I'm taking it." And that was it, because he owned the theaters in New York. And he opened it in a couple of weeks. And, you know, and Jane Fonda was on the Carson show one night and mentioned what a lovely experience she had with the film. And the next day had a little audience around the country.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Who would have figured that?
Yeah, Jane Fonda is your advocate, right?
Yeah, I don't know her.
How did African-American audiences react to it?
I think, there was a 40th anniversary screening in Harlem a few years ago, and my wife and I and about four or five other people went up, and then everybody else there was black. It was about 400 people at the Schomburg Center, and the Q&A was longer than the movie. It was great. It was like it was their film. It was great. I had no idea, because back when it came out, there was a lot of people saying, you know, this is offensive and this and that and that and this. But I think over time it has settled in and just become what it is, whatever that is.
When I think about Putney Swope, it's kind of one of the first films I can think of that does a lot of humor about advertising. I mean, it predates like a lot of the satire of advertising that we would see maybe 5 or 6 years later when Saturday Night Live gets rolling. And what was sort of your inspiration to do that kind of thing? Because really, was there a lot of that at the time that you could kind of...
No, because I told you, I worked at that place that made commercials, and I was making experimental commercials. So it was fun to fool around. And then I met the guys at Saturday Night Live, and a couple of them told me they used to go see it all the time, especially her, the Gilda Radner. I mean, now the commercials that are on television, they don't even tell you what the product is anymore. They just give you stuff to look at. And now that I know what it is, why would I want it?
Right.
Where are you guys, in Detroit?
Yep.
Well, must have been fun to have these jokers up there in a primary. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I've never seen anything like it. You can't. I mean, satire is dead now because of these guys.
I think Colbert does a pretty good job of, you know, sending them up sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I see that. But the real thing is funnier, I think. I mean, I've never thought I'd live to see these people. You know, I think, you know, I don't want to be too heavy about this, but I think when all those assassinations happened back with the Kennedys and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and other people being shot at, that little kids saw that going into politics and believing in something is going to get you killed. And I think they passed the word on. That's why you have all these morons today, because if anybody with a brain wouldn't go into that, they'd be, well, I'm worried Obama's going to get nailed.
Yeah, and there's been things like that they've talked about, and it's not very good. You know, it's kind of talking about that influence there, though, with Putney Swope. I mean, as you said, you know, the guys at Saturday Night Live, the group Tube, things like that. I mean, we look now, and there's, like, scenes that have been lifted or ideas that have been lifted from Putney Swope, people like the Coen brothers and Paul Thomas Anderson. What do you think, like, looking back on it, you know, how do you feel about...
When did the Coen brothers lift anything? I'd like to know that.
Have you seen Hudsucker Proxy? There's that whole scene in the beginning in the boardroom where the CEO jumps out the window.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's Tim Robbins, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it kind of seems like they took some of the ideas of what you were laying down and put their own spin on it in a way.
That's good. Well, Paul, I know a long time. I knew him before he made a feature. He's going to do the interview with me for the box set.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, he's a good guy. I've seen 90 minutes of his new movie, too. It's great. He's an interesting character. He's actually the West Coast Marty Scorsese in a way. I mean, he knows every film that was ever shot and every, you know, he's one of those guys.
Does he talk as fast as Scorsese?
No. No. In fact, he asked me if he could use the firecracker thing in Boogie Nights. I said, of course. And it was fun. I like that film.
And you had a part in it, too. I always liked your part.
Yeah, he gets
well.
Me to show up. once in a while, if I'm around, I come in for an hour and I can't learn lines, but I come in and improvise or whatever and work a little with what he's written. And these are good guys, these guys who fight to do films that are original. I mean, it's not easy now. It's getting harder. The studios don't even consider films about people anymore. That's over.
When he first contacted you and talked to you about you and your work and things like that, I mean, what was it that he said that really attracted him?
Some woman that he was working with on his first film, who I kind of knew a little bit, called me up and said, would you read a script by a guy? I said, I can't read another screenplay. I was living in L.A. at the time. I can't even read my own. And so she said, I guarantee this one. I said, okay. And it was called Sydney, which became Hard Eight.
Oh, that's a great one.
Yeah. And so I knew him before that. And he, in fact, I just saw him. I had to go out to California when my son was honored by the Cinematheque. And I saw Paul out there, and he's got three kids, and he's quite a character.
On the audio commentary for Putney, you were talking about doing some project with Paul. This had to have been a few years ago. Whatever became of that?
He was interested in my teenage years when I was in and out of prison in the Army. And I think he at one time thought that that kind of stuff might be interesting. I guess he's heard a lot of the stories from me. And I remember kind of talking about that. He's talked about it other times, but he's got a lot of thoughts on his mind. He's always thinking.
Getting back to Putney just for a little bit more, for me, it really kind of reminds me a lot of Animal Farm. You know, you have these disenfranchised people that get into power, and then Putney is just going around being so abusive and firing everyone. Were you trying to make a point maybe of how kind of the revolutionaries were kind of eating themselves? You know, this is the time that Nation of Islam is coming about and all this kind of stuff. Or was it just it made for a better story?
Maybe a little of both. All I remember is if this guy's going to take over a toilet, he's not going to make it better.
Right.
That's how I look at it as far as advertising. A bunch of people told me they used to on their lunch hour back then go over to the cinema too, which was close to Madison Avenue. It was like three blocks, and just watch the film with a bunch of friends and then go back to work. You know, people worked at ad agencies back in 69. That wasn't, you know, employed as in an ad agency, but I could see what was going on. And plus they used to come over where the commercials were made and they'd have lunches and cocktail parties and they'd talk, you know, and I'd listen, I guess. And I was surprised that kind of nonsense hadn't been done before by a movie. But maybe the combination of the social thing and the advertising thing and consumerism and blah, 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 I don't want to sound too highfalutin, maybe that all connected into one thing that was maybe real in a way. I don't know.
After Putney Swope comes out, you had someone who came up and decided they wanted to give you some money, and then you made Pound. Can you kind of talk about how that developed?
And one thing about Pound I will tell you, that when we turned it into the United Artists who put up the money for it, when the screening was over, the editor and I were sitting there and the head of the studio turns around and said, I thought this was going to be animated. And then I found out nobody really read it.
Oh, man.
Yeah, they couldn't. They disowned that film in a way. But I think they punished me by putting me on a double bill with a Fellini film, you know, in second run.
How did kind of Pound develop for you? I mean, from an idea and then being able to make it?
Well, I was lucky. I think because of Putney, this one guy started paying me to write whatever I wanted. And I had written a play about the same thing that was much different, but just about 18 people playing dogs waiting to be adopted. If they don't get adopted, they get put to sleep. And we just got enough money to barely get it done. So it was a great experience.
I love your use of like the dream sequences in that.
I don't know how you even get a hold of Pound now. I had to find a digibeta a couple of years ago and straighten it out. I don't know how you could even see it.
Rob has a pretty low quality copy, but I've got a pretty high quality. It's a DVD-R and it's got time code on the bottom, but the picture is pretty darn clear.
Really? Oh, that's it. I should get Criterion to clean up the internet before they release all my stuff. That's been taken from theaters back then, and somebody with a camera, you can't blah blah whatever they did. and just get rid of all the stuff, because this stuff is watchable that'll be coming out.
Pound is not part of this new collection. Okay.
It's Fabo 73, Chafed Elbows, No More Excuses, 2 tons of turquoise to Taos Tonight, formerly Moment to Moment, and Putney Swope. They're adding to it.
Is Pound kind of tied up legally, or what's...
Yeah, United Artists really, they owned it last, but I only got lucky because somebody had found a print of it in somebody's closet again. And then I got it, and I was able to take it to a lab, and I said, oh, my God, there's 8 minutes that can come out. So I edited some more of it years later, and that was fun. And now I have a digibeta, and there are a couple of DVDs, and there's some talk maybe they'll put out more of my stuff. Who knows?
That would be wonderful.
Yeah, that would
be great. Yeah, go to color. I'm not happy. Greases, I like the color, but most color is not as good as black and white, to me anyway, not as interesting. People look better in black and white.
One of the things that I really loved about Pound was you had a lot of the recurring cast from Putney and also from some of your shorts. And one of the things in there, obviously, for people who are, you know, not a lot of folks have gotten to see it. I mean, like I said, I've got a beat up like fifth generation VHS with a time code in it, is casting your son, Robert Downey Jr.
Oh, that is first time out. Yeah.
Yeah. So what was it like trying to get a 5-year-old to deliver your lines and act?
The next morning we go upstairs, there's no more furniture, the roof's gone, and so's my hair. That tornado scared me so much it made my hair disappear.
Have any hair on your balls?
After the first take, he was bored. You know, because he heard everybody say how great it was, and I think I had to do it again, and he kind of let me know he didn't want to do it after the second one, that's for sure, you know, which in a way extends to who he is. Well, if you look at Tropic Thunder and things that he does, it's like, I guess I have to say he's a natural.
You know, talking about Pound is not available, really. Some other films of yours, I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about Sticks and Bones.
Oh, that's a thing I did for CBS for Joe Papp, based on a David Rabe play. And it ended up being so tough for CBS to take that they put it on the air with no commercials, if you can imagine. And Joe Papp, the New York Shakespeare Festival guy, produced it and asked me to do it after he saw Grease's Pals. He's one of the greatest characters I've ever run into, Joe Papp. And he snuck it in with some Shakespeare. They never read this. And then when they saw it, they didn't know what to do.
I've been looking for a copy of that for years. Did that ever come out?
No.
Can you tell me, too, about The Sweet Smell of Sex?
Oh, yeah. I forgot exactly when it was. It was in the 60s. My daughter had been born, and it was in Bellevue, and it was not a good... It was a vacation week or something, and they didn't have enough doctors, and it was a tough birth. So I was looking for a way to make sure my next kid was born in a legit hospital that's safe and blah, blah, blah. And somebody offered me money to write, direct, cut, score, and finish a film for 42nd Street, which wasn't X-rated yet, in like 2 months, you know, the whole thing. I cast a girl from the World's Fair as somebody who comes to New York every summer and pays for her visit by selling herself and then returns to Indiana. Only this year, every guy she hooks up with either has a heart attack or doesn't have the money. She's really attractive, too. And this one guy on the street is always, when she leaves these guys, is always catching up to her saying, would you have dinner with me? And finally, she's exhausted from the whole thing and says, okay, and they go to dinner, and he takes her home and strangles her to death.
Oh, man.
So you can imagine what happened on 42nd Street with that one.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, that was fun. And we can't find it. The Criterion wanted to find it because they'd heard about it, but we can't find it. It was only a couple of prints. And Tom O'Hogan did the music in like 2 takes for the whole film. He did Babo 73 and Chafed Elbows, too. And Babo 73, the music is even better. He did some job.
Yeah, well, I'm dying to see that. I can't wait to see how that is and to listen to it.
I think it all comes out in May.
Yeah, that's going to be great.
I was going to ask actually about those restorations. When they came to you and wanted to restore them, you talked a little bit about it. You said Martin Scorsese was behind it and Anthology was behind it.
It's his foundation.
For you, though, I mean, what did you think about the fact that people wanted to go back and clean it up? Yeah.
I was shocked, and I didn't know how to find even this stuff. But this guy, Andrew Lambert, down at the Anthology was like very on the case. And we found somehow like half a film somewhere, and then an actor had a print of another film, and finally he was able to take the prints and make new negatives out of that. That's where the restoration comes from. And I was shocked that this ever happened. So I'm thrilled that it has.
I was curious about, years ago I read about you working with Hal Ashby.
Yeah, well, that was my best friend. In California, yeah. There's a book. Do you know about the book Being Hal Ashby?
No.
You guys are missing something.
Okay, I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, check it out. Find it on Amazon. Being Hal Ashby by Nick Dawson. What a book. If you want to know anything about Hal Ashby, it's all in there. And this kid got it right, too. Yeah, it'll make you cry, too.
The script that I read about, it was called what? Victor Hiatus?
That's right.
This sounds amazing. Whatever happened?
I had written this thing, and he read it, and he had this deal at this place that made Being There, who really didn't understand Being There. That was, you'll read all this in the book. And he said, listen, while I'm situated over here, why don't I get them to, I forget the words he used, but basically purchase your script and I'll say I'm going to direct it, and then you'll get paid and blah, blah, blah. I said, Hal, I've never heard of anything like this. He said, well, just do it. So I got over there, and they paid me for the script I'd already written. And Hal said he was going to direct it. I think he really wanted to. It was just a little bit too, I don't know what, but for a studio. And he just loved doing that. That's the kind of guy he was.
Recently, you had an appearance in Tower Heist. How did that come about?
Oh, God. I've known him a while, Brett, and he's called me a couple of times to be in his films. I was in another one. I forget the name. It was Nicolas Cage and Family Man. So he asked me to join that one. That was easy to improvise. And then he asked me to jump up here, and so I jumped up there and showed up, you know, and you get residuals. I can't learn much, you know, the dialogue and stuff. I can write some, but I can't learn it.
Your main claim to fame is as a writer and a director, and you kind of talked about it a little bit. You're working on a few things. Is there anything you can talk about?
Actually, I'm finishing a script in the next few weeks. I got a nice draft. I've been on it quite a while, and then I'm going to go out and try and raise the money. So if you know anybody in Detroit who's got some hidden money and wants to be a producer, have them call me.
That was what I was going to ask. I mean, what do you think, like, the kids nowadays who have the digital opportunity maybe can learn by going back and looking at your stuff or that whole underground New York scene? What do you think you guys can teach them?
I don't know. I just know that, to generalize, back then with the so-called underground alternative, whatever you want to call it, there was very little humor in those films. And when there was, Flower Thief and a couple of other things, Relativity and certain films like that, it was so refreshing to get a laugh you're not going to get anywhere else, or to see somebody trying something. One of the great characters, Kuchar Brothers, you know about them?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think George just died. And they were great. They actually had a couple of their films on double bill with some of my stuff. Yeah, they make films about their mother in the kitchen and the neighborhood and whatever. They had a nice spirit, those guys. So they stood out. But to pass on to the people that are doing it now, to answer your question, I'd say, you know, with the digital thing, you have no excuse. Just go out and do it.
Yeah, it was so nice seeing Chafed Elbows. You know, just it is so funny, and so many great one-liners, and I love the thing with the guy painting the line.
I knew you were going to say that.
I just love it. I don't know.
That was not only fun, it was over in one take because people were starting to worry about us painting the fucking street, you know? Painting a line down the middle of the street.
But that's the thing that's so great about those shorts, the stuff that you did, is that it does have humor. I mean, like when you look at the other stuff that's contemporary that I think people go, oh, this is the important stuff of that era. Like you said, it's all very serious. It's all very, you know, this is important art, you know, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Can you imagine that Warhol shit I used to sit through? Come on. That was dreadful.
Except hours of the freaking Empire State Building.
Yeah, try some of that for a while. But I'll tell you what wasn't bad was Trash.
Yeah, I agree with that one.
Yeah, that one actually had a nice little thing to it. I thought that was just an ugly girl. I didn't even know it was a guy till after the film was over. That's true.
I'm not trying to blow smoke up your ass or anything, but I love the structure of Chafed Elbows, too.
And I didn't know there was any. But thanks anyway.
Well, you know, just the way that you go from the stills to the moving scenes, and then, you know, the use of the voiceover and how he's like, you know, that was my first breakdown. Now here's my second one, and I like this one better.
And I shot a lot of that myself, the stills, because I had a little Canon camera. With a bang, 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 and then I would just turn them into slides and then pick the ones I wanted and then go back to the negative and put it on an animation stand and then film the originals of the slides I've picked. You know, we used to, as you've probably heard this, take my rushes to the drugstores where we developed this stuff and then turned it into film later and then broke it up with motion pictures along with the stills and then the music and the whole thing and, you know, got lucky.
That's just the kind of stuff I'm talking about, you know, just breaking it up and not making it all, you know, Ligeti or something, you know, and having the humor in there, I thought was terrific.
Oh, great. I'm glad you... Listen, maybe you're telling me that this box set will do okay.
I hope so.
Yeah, that would be nice. You talk about people who love what they do, like Criterion.
I can only imagine.
Yeah, someday you ought to find a way in there just to see what, you know, the posters alone and the people and the attitude, and it's a real lucky thing, you know. I mean, and they have fun, too.
Well, I definitely know you have two sales. Mike and I plan on buying one, so.
Exactly. Okay, good.
I was going to ask you, would you mind doing a show ID for us while we got you on the phone?
I don't know what that is.
It would just be saying, you know, hi, this is Robert Downey, and I'm in the projection booth.
Hi, I'm Robert Downey, and I'm in the projection booth.
Perfect. I'm going to ask you one more, and this is kind of obnoxious.
I'll give you one, too. I walked into a screening of Chafed Elbows in the 60s at the Gate Theater, and the image was all over the theater. It was moving around. I went up in the projection booth, and this is back in the days of drugs. The projectionist was hand-holding the projector. And I said to him, I said something like, what's going on? And he said, I'm having fun. Do you mind? So that brought, go ahead. What's your other question?
My other thing, I was wondering if you could do that, that one as in the Putney voice.
Hi, I'm Robert Downey, and I'm in the projection booth.
Wonderful. That is great.
Awesome.
That's got to hurt your throat after a while, man.
It's gone. It was gone about a week after I did the dubbing back then.
Jim Karanga of Watts, California, is eating a bowl of ethereal cereal, the heavenly breakfast food. Jim, did you know that ethereal cereal has twice as much vitamin B as any other leading cereal? Ethereal also has the added punch of 0.002 ESP units of pectin.
No shit!
it was great. Just amazing coincidence that we were talking to him on the day that Criterion announced that whole new box thing. And I was glad that we were able to ask him about that. That's coming out through their, Eclipse label, which is kind of their no-frills box set type of label. So unfortunately, it sounds like none of the, the extras that we've seen on various releases of Putney over the years. There's one that has an interview on it. There's one that has an interview and commentary. I'm very curious if those are going to kind of get transferred over to this release or if they're just going to strip all that stuff away.
Well, see, usually with the Eclipse boxes, they don't put extras on it. It's usually just the film. I don't even think they bother to put trailers or anything on it. For me, it's kind of a balance. It's like, okay, I'm glad that they're releasing all of this other stuff that, as we were talking to Mr. Downey, we had been able to get through, pirate sources because literally they had never been released. So I'm happy about that. But on the negative is that there are these versions of Putney Swope that are out there. They've been out there for over a decade, one of which was put out by Home Visions, which I think might have some kind of connection, at least to the Criterion guys. They are aware of Home Visions because they put out some similar stuff or they've traded films from time to time to do that kind of thing. I don't understand why they wouldn't be willing to spend a couple of extra dollars to put those extras on that Putney disc and make it the definitive disc. Because while I'm going to pick up the box set because I, want to see all of these other pieces now completely restored, it just kind of upsets me that it's like I still have to hang on to an older disc if I want that commentary, if I want those interviews, if I want all that stuff. And it's like it'd be nice if they would just put it all together in one place. So if the Criterion folks hear this before they get a chance to put it out, I am throwing down the challenge to you to do that.
I doubt very much that they're going to change the direction that that train is heading down right now, but that would be nice. What would really be nice, though, I think, is if they dug out Pound and put Pound on there, but I don't think that's going to happen either.
Pound is one that, as we were talking about, I've got like this beat up old tape that Steve over at Shock Cinema like 12 years ago was nice enough to dub for me and send it to me along with a few other Robert Downey shorts. And that's how I originally got a chance to see some of this older stuff after I'd gotten into Putney Swope. But, it's my understanding that MGM, who put the money up in order to make the movie, has kind of been sitting on it. And what's interesting is there's really kind of a big gap in Robert Downey's filmography, at least in those early films, is that it goes from Putney Swope to Greaser's Palace, which is in 72, and there is Pound right in the middle, and you don't get a chance to see the evolution. So I'm hoping that at some point, maybe MGM can do something. I mean, I know you're familiar with the Warner Archives stuff, where isn't that sort of a print-on-demand kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly. And MGM is doing that as well. It's definitely not as widely known. I mean, it's kind of, I'll be honest, it's difficult to even find that stuff off of their own site. And it's really just kind of a crapshoot whether I can ever find that page again on the internet.
Oh, man. And as I was talking about to other people before, when I talk about Pound, I go, here's the first film of now a guy who's a major bankable star in Hollywood, Robert Downey Jr. He was 5 years old when he was in Pound. And you think some enterprising guy at the studio who's looking to make a couple of extra bucks is going to go, you know what? Let's put this out and put Robert Downey on the front, Robert Downey Jr., and say, hey, here's, his first film and really play that up. I'm sure that all the Robert Downey Sr. fans will come and pick it up. But you'll also get a few people who are interested just to see a very young Robert Downey Jr. in his first role.
Yeah, I mean, they do that for every other star. I mean, oh, look it. Here's, Brad Pitt in Cutting Class. And here's Renee Zellweger in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, or, Family Reunion or whatever it was. And here's, I remember when working at the video store and Kevin Costner was getting hot and it was, Fandango was all over the place. come on.
There's enterprising ways to make money off the fact that this is a first film with someone. So it's like, why don't you do it? MGM, get off your dead ass and give us Pound, will you please?
Yeah, come on, guys. Really?
But it's also that way, really, to be honest. I mean, with a lot of Downey's stuff, a lot of it is not available. Even the stuff that he did in the late 70s and into the 80s and even early 90s, like the last film that I can think of that got any kind of release, maybe theatrical, I'm not sure if it did or not, but definitely on video, was Hugo Pool, which also has Alyssa Milano in it and Malcolm McDowell and Robert Downey Jr. And there's about two or three other movies from the early 80s to early 90s that also feature Robert Downey Jr. working with his dad that have yet to be released. Things like Too Much Sun and Rented Lips for Two that I've never been able to see because, as far as I know, they've never been put out there. So once again, someone has this in the vaults and, you know, it's got Iron Man in it. You know, how much money did that movie make? Let's put this stuff out. Let's give people a chance to see all the work of Robert Downey Sr., as much of it as we can get out there.
Yeah, you would think, I mean, somebody that knows their marketing would say, you know, as soon as The Avengers comes out, they're going to be releasing this kind of stuff on DVD. You know, it's like, it's just, it makes sense. You know, it's like those people that put out the crappy 1970 animated version of The Little Mermaid when The Little Mermaid is coming out on VHS or being re-released on DVD. You know, there were so many people that would come into different video stores. I mean, back when there were such things as video stores, and pick up these things and be like, oh yeah, my kid's a huge fan of The Little Mermaid. It's like, you know, that's some knockoff, right? It doesn't matter. It's $5. It doesn't know.
Exactly.
So yeah, you know, put little Robert Downey Jr. or, you know, teenage or 20-year-old Robert Downey Jr. on the cover there and say, you know, star of the Avengers, you know, put him in a red and yellow suit and see what sells.
Well, I mean, I don't even want to be that sort of like exploitive. I mean, I understand that some of it may end up going that way, but it's like it deserves just to be released on its own merits. And that's the thing that I would really like to see is that I think Robert Downey Sr. is a guy who has had impact. He has had an influence. I mean, obviously, people are interested in his stuff. Otherwise, Anthology Film Archive and Martin Scorsese's foundation would not have spent the money to find and restore his early short films. So this stuff is important and it needs to be released and he needs to be respected, you know, on the level with every other filmmaker. He needs I think, you know, the thing that was interesting is when I said we were going to do this episode, we were going to talk to him. People got really excited when I said Robert Downey because they thought his son. And then not a lot of folks know that his dad was a filmmaker. I'm not talking cinephiles like us. I'm talking just average everyday folks don't know that there is a guy, this guy, and he did some amazing work and he deserves, you know, to get some attention for it.
Right. Well, I think he was kind of ghettoized because he was using humor, and not a lot of the underground filmmakers of the time were as funny as Robert Downey was. I mean, when you go through and read Film as a Subversive Art, you know, you're not seeing a lot of comedy being at the forefront of these films, of these experimental films. And that's what he was doing. He was making experimental movies. I mean, Chafed Elbows is amazing in the way that it blends, you know, still photos and live action. And, you know, all of these different ideas are going on through this film. But then it's funny.
To me, like, comedy always seems to be put in a ghetto. It's like comedy and horror film and sci-fi. It's like that all goes in a ghetto. It's like these things can't have the same good impact or isn't high art compared to drama. And as we talked to Mr. Downey about, in that you have these underground films that at the time he was doing, then he's like, man, I had to sit through that Warhol stuff. It's horrible. You know, it's just boring. I think what's really interesting is he was taking comedy and he was using it to not only entertain but make points, satire at the same time, and it still holds up. And some of these underground films, which I do respect and I absolutely love, they are very serious. You have to take them that this is stuff that we would put on the wall in like a major art museum, and that's why they were created. Well, Bob Downey's stuff to me seems like it could go on the wall there, but it would probably be better for like folks who are into like the Marx Brothers or something like that. It's like it can talk to two audiences that way. It's not only high art, but it's also comedy in that way. And that's why I really dig it. I think it still holds up. I think it's fun to watch. And he does just a great job with these early shorts. And like I said, I'm looking forward to seeing them, you know, as close to what they were supposed to look like when they first came out, because these restorations, I'm willing to bet, are going to be pretty amazing.
Exactly. Yeah, he embraces anarchy, which I really respect.
And you get the feeling that maybe that goes from father to son, too, at least in terms of stories we've heard and in terms of the work that his son has done over the years.
Exactly. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, if there aren't a whole lot of actors out there that were working with, you know, the caliber of filmmaker of a Robert Downey Sr., you know, from the time that they were born, basically. So he, you know, he definitely has the chops.
We're going to take a break and play a preview from next week's show.
City's most dangerous criminals.
You think you scare me?
Have been invited to play the world's most dangerous game.
To win, you eliminate the competition. The prize is $10 million.
Now everyone is a moving target.
Get down, Lucy.
And the only way to survive...
Having a good time, little girl?
...is to play the game.
Okay, I got one.
Play the game and finish it.
We have to kill them all!
Christopher Lambert, Ice-T.
Are there any other questions?
What if we don't want to play?
Meet Guns.
Any other questions?
All right, be sure to tune in when we'll be joined by Fred Fritz of the Erase Rewind podcast as we talk about Albert Pune's Mean Guns.
I don't want to sound like a broken record here, Mike, but I just want to say thanks again to Mr. Downey. It was great to get a chance to talk to him. He's actually, you know, one of my favorite filmmakers whose work just constantly impresses me. I can go back to and really enjoy. And as I said, truly a prince.
Definitely. That was wonderful. So be sure to stop on by www.projection-booth.com for more of the Projection Booth, or listen to us via iTunes, Stitcher, or Jackalope Radio. Also, leave us some comments on our previous shows, what you liked, what you didn't like, what can we improve on, do we need to wear pants while we're recording these kind of shows. Give us some feedback, give us a rating over on iTunes. Help spread the gospel of the Projection Booth.
You can't eat an air conditioner.